the juvies can't be charged like the adults can oftentimes, so they're the ones really doing a lot of the dirty work.
You've got the clearance rate for homicides down at like 20 and 25% because nobody will assist the police in solving the crime.
And when I said paid him back, he was buying $5, $10 at a time. Through street sources, he owed them 15 bucks. So that's what his life was worth.
2 a.m., you're sound asleep at home, thinking you're going to get a good night's rest, and the phone rings.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello and welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today electronically is...
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes, former state and federal prosecutor. Jim, I am once again on assignment out here on the rainy East Coast. I know you miss me.
Well, everything is relative, Francie. Everything is relative. But today we have with us a very special guest co-host...
Maureen O'Connell, retired FBI agent.
And
Larry Grajeda, former Hawthorne PD.
And Larry, I'm just meeting you for the first time today. How you doing?
I'm good, sir. How are you?
You're very fortunate that Francie is on the other side of the country today.
Hey, Jim, don't give brand new guests a bad impression.
Oh, Francie, I'm sorry, but you generally do that yourself. But anyway, no, I meant to say, fortunately, Francie gets to join us from the other side of the country. That's what I meant, right? Uh-huh. And Maureen is here to give me hell because you're across the country.
Because it's there's
well, somebody's got to do it, Jim. That's the thing. Larry will learn because I'm certain Larry is going to be a frequent recurring guest because of his fantastic experience, about which I'd like to hear more.
Great. Well, tell us, first of all, about the Hawthorne PD. Where is it? How big is it? All that kind of stuff.
Hawthorne PD, it's about 100 officers. The Hawthorne, the city, is about 6 square miles. Not a big department. It's in the Alley area, probably about 4 miles from, I guess, if you want to pinpoint it, LAX.
Wow, that's pretty close by. There's a lot of interesting technology over there in Hawthorne, isn't there?
Oh, there sure is. I mean, everybody else's technology is ours, so it's the same thing. You know, we try to be a beach city, but weren't that close. So,
but I mean, you have SpaceX and Tesla right there, right?
We do, and hopefully, we can keep them there because yeah. That's probably a good shot for Hawthorne to keep its budget going. So,
yeah. Well, I know Elon Musk and two of my one nephew and one niece are SpaceX people. So we're really happy that they're so close by. Pretty amazing what they've been able to do. When Josh started there, I believe he was the youngest rocket scientist in the history of the country. He was 20 years old, just graduated from engineering school and got a job there on his merits. And literally, it was a whole bunch of his roommates, you know, just 20-something young kids doing amazing things.
With no inhibitions, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he's Elon himself is building quite a few off-site living quarters, probably mostly for these people that are working there. But, you know, on the other hand, you got the upcoming football stadium that's just right next door to us. That's probably going to have a good chance of creating quite a few jobs in Hawthorne. And I'm sure revenue will go up quite a bit. So
that's great. And what about the possible crime increase as a result of that stadium?
You know, I don't see it. 90s crime was rampant in Hawthorne, and now it's just, you know, 70% drop. It literally has gone down that much. I just see a lot more of the traffic and everything like that. So whether it hits Hawthorne or Inglewood, I mean, nobody knows. I think when you put a lot of people in one certain area, you're going to have your little crimes, but I don't think it's going to be anything that they need to worry about.
Okay.
I was just going to say that even though Hawthorne is a seemingly smaller department, the huge cases that have come out of there for the FBI is literally in Hawthorne almost every single solitary day.
Really?
Yes.
Doing what kind of cases?
Fugitive cases. They do a lot of, the head of the Fugitive Task Force said his favorite department in Los Angeles was the Hawthorne Police Department.
Really? Did that have anything to do with the fact that your better half used to work there for 30 something years.
It actually preceded that, but yeah, that didn't hurt any, you know, he for sure. And they're known to be a very, very proactive, old-fashioned police department, which is great.
Well, that's awesome. So let's dive into this case that you're thinking about. Where were you in your career when this case came to you?
I was in my eighth year, and they had just closed down the Metro gang unit, budget cuts, and they shipped me off to the Detective Bureau for about a year and a half.
Okay. So is this your first time being a detective, or were you a detective on the gang unit?
First time.
Okay.
Well, as a gang and Metro, you were a detective, but okay. That's all you worked was gangs and narcotics and vice.
All right.
Okay. Not like the regular detectives work all the other crimes.
Can you just describe what you mean by Metro? I think all of us with law enforcement backgrounds might know, but lots of listeners, especially our international listeners, won't necessarily know. So what is Metro?
Metro was a conglomerate of different entities, I guess you could say. Narcotics, vice, fugitives, parolees, probation searches, anything and everything. We were an extended arm of the regular Detective Bureau. If they needed us to go try to capture one of their outstanding suspects, then we do that. So we did quite a bit. And of course, the gang portion of that, all we did was handle gang type crimes.
Okay, so you were a detective with a new assignment. And what happened on the day this particular case you're thinking about came in?
Well, in our bureau, because we're so the personnel, we don't have the manpower, you had rotating shifts. So each 7 days, a different set of detectives would be on call. If there was a homicide that happened after 5 o'clock or something that you needed to go in, then they would call you. Just so happened that was my time to be called in. And at about 2 a.m, I received a call along with my partner that there was a homicide victim from a shooting and we needed to roll in.
So 2 a.m. So you're sound asleep at home thinking you're going to get a good night's rest and the phone rings.
Not so fast. Yeah.
So what information did you get in that initial phone call?
Well, as all call-ins, you shoot down to the police department, talk to either the Hanley sergeant, lieutenant, the commander, and they will brief you on what happened. And all we had at that time was that there was a male subject in his 50s that was shot twice and is in front of a house on our northwest section of our city.
What kind of neighborhood is that?
That at that time, it was run, I'd say, by some gang that was called the 11-8s, Eucalyptus Mobster Crips, and they got that.
Okay, wait. We have to stop for a second. What are you talking about?
Yeah, eucalyptus. Yeah. So there was a street, 118th.
What was the name of it again?
118th Street.
Uh-huh.
That crossed with Eucalyptus Avenue. They kind of held down that area, and they just called themselves Eucalyptus Mobsters.
But if you're going to be tough guys, anything with eucalyptus in it, I'm sorry. It just sounds like, why don't you just say, you know, the Daisy Chain Gang?
It's a spa ingredient, Jim. You can find eucalyptus in every spa.
Yeah, but spa and mobster gangs, I don't think they mix, Francie. That's my opinion.
It's actually fairly common for street gangs to be named after the street where the gang originated.
I know. I would have moved to a different street. Yeah. Like, you know, I'm sorry, but if you said, you know, the 118th and Granite Mobsters, that sounds like a serious gang. But eucalyptus? I don't know. I'm not feeling it. But anyway, tell me about this gang.
At that time, that gang was probably 30 to 50 deep, run by some older guys. And when I say older, I'm talking about late 20s. Newer guys were 17, 18, 19. Those are the ones you had to worry about because they're still trying to make a name for themselves.
Yeah. And what does that mean?
Putting in the work, doing most of the activity, robbing, selling, shootings.
Especially juvies, because the juvies can't be charged like the adults can oftentimes. So they're the ones really doing a lot of the dirty work.
But also juveniles with guns have no respect for life. Aren't they dangerous?
They're probably more dangerous. Because like I said, they're putting in the work and they want to earn their stripes. They want that reputation. So that's what you have to worry about, both as a citizen and as an officer.
Okay, so what happened?
So believe it or not, my partner at that time ended up retiring before I did as the chief of police with the Hawthorne Police Department. But at that time, he was a detective. We jumped into our detective bureau car and drove to the location, which is a single family residence and basically just single family houses and apartment complexes within that square mile.
Okay, so you get there and what do you find?
We had an understanding when we worked our homicides that we called in the sheriffs. So the sheriffs took the handle and we assisted. Sheriffs were already on scene and the crime scene was ordered preserves, all the police tape up and all the officers around. And we see a gentleman lying on the driveway, pretty close to the steps of the front porch to the single family residence with several gunshots to his upper torso.
Okay, so it's dark out. You're there with the sheriff's detectives. And what happens?
Well, like any other case, you're, you know, canvassing. You talk to the initial responding officers who really just give you the basic. They get a call, the shot's fired. They arrive on scene. They see this gentleman, try to revive him, nothing. Fire comes in, pronounce. And now you're trying to talk to the occupants and any witnesses in that area.
Okay, so when you say fire comes in, the paramedics arrive, they pronounce him dead on the scene, and then you start doing your investigation?
Correct.
So what's the initial information that you have? Were there any eyewitnesses? Was there any information to convey to you at that time?
Well, what we gathered was the deceased, the victim, was sitting on the porch with the residents at that house, talking, drinking. Suddenly, the two residents that are out with the victim, they go inside, and two to three guys come down the street. He sees the guys, apparently sees the gun, tries to knock on the door and bang on the door to try to get inside. They would not let him inside. Shots are fired. The two to three suspects run back north and are not seen. And when they open the door, he is dead. However, after talking to the residents and the friends and everything, they had nothing whatsoever to say. Didn't see anything, heard shots, didn't know anything about who did what. So,
well, from a timeline standpoint, the fact that they were out there drinking, partying, then they both went into the house right when it happened and wouldn't let him in.
And locked the door.
And locked the door. It sounds like they
set
got
up.
Some splaining to do, yep.
Yes, they did, but they stayed hard, steadfast on not knowing anything.
So what happened?
Well, that's not a surprise to anybody.
It's not unusual.
No, it's not unusual. Nobody wants to get involved, you know, retaliation, all that good stuff. So canvass the area, process the scene, process as much as we could. Contacted every resident on that neighborhood from about a block all the way down. People heard shots, but nobody saw any.
Were there any casings around? Were there any indications of what caliber weapon was used?
No casings. So we knew either they picked them up or it's a revolver.
Right.
Okay.
So Larry, when you say that you all are canvassing the neighborhood and contacting people, are you doing all that yourselves? And are you literally walking house to house? How does that work? Describe that process for our listeners.
So when you have the initial response, officers, after locking down the crime scene, and when I mean locking it down, putting on the crime scene tape and not letting anybody in or out, they'll also knock on doors and neighbors and trying to get information before the detectives even arrive. Once we arrive and investigate the initial crime and everything that happened around that house, then we, detectives and officers, will then conduct a door knock of every neighbor in that area, canvass the area, try in hopes that we can get some information of obviously an eyewitness to the crime. But in this case, everybody just heard shots but didn't see anything.
So it's you get the call at 2 a.m. What time is it that you're knocking on everybody's doors?
4, 5 in the morning. As you can imagine, most of them are still asleep and don't want to answer the door. So you leave your business card and hope that they call you back. So having worked in narcotics before, in our narcotic world, you work a lot of your cases through informants.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe through my career, informants were the most important or the benefit for me, because informants know everything. They're out on the street. They provide you information. And I really relied on that through my mm-hmm. career.
Yep.
So about a week and a half later, I'm walking down the street trying to find somebody that might know anything. And I come upon an ex-informant of mine that I hadn't seen in about 8 years, 7, 8 years. And he's smoking, hardcore gang member from another gang neighborhood up in LA. Didn't even realize he lived in that area. He comes up to me and he says, "I know what you're looking for, Grade." And I'm like, "What's that?" And he goes, "I'm telling you right now, I'm going to tell you this, but you're never going to hear from me again. You ever ask me, I said, I'll tell you you're a liar because I'm not a snitch." But apparently he happened to be smoking right down the street from where the shooting happened. He sees three guys jump the wall, walk eastbound, then go south And he knew, just being from the streets, something's about to happen. He goes inside to light a cigarette. He hears shots. He goes back to his front door, looks out, and those same three guys are running and go back down the driveway to an apartment complex, which he called the cut, went back over the wall out of sight.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, working the streets and being an informant or gang member or you being a cop, there's a certain body language that goes along with people when they're about to do something like that. And there's also a very distinctive body language when they're getting away from a situation like that. So I'm sure that's exactly what that informant saw.
Right, right. And you said a couple times he's smoking. Is he smoking regular cigarettes? Is he smoking crack? What's going on there?
Smoking cigarettes. And this guy, his whole family were gang members, and he's the youngest of a lot of them. He's from a Hoover gang, and he was just, you know, he was 21 at the time, but he was old for his age. He just knew the streets, and he said it was the 11-8s, the gang that I told you about, but you didn't hear it from me. So again, good information, one person, gang member, credibility. Okay, let's go with that, right? So you start looking into it, but the next day, go back to try to talk to him. Apartment empty, and they had moved out. The informant had moved.
When I was an FBI profiler, I worked some of the world's most difficult cases. That's why I like to come home to furniture that's relaxing, but hip and cool. And with joybird.com/bestcase, you can do that too. It's time your furniture matches your fearless style. Your furniture should suit your needs, but also feel uniquely you. That's where Joybird comes in. Endless customizable options means the days of settling are over. With Joybird, your personal one-of-a-kind style should match your furniture. Bring your mood boards to life with hundreds of customizable pieces and over 50 fabric and leather options, 3 shades of wood, and over 250 unique silhouettes. From rich buttery leathers to the softest velvets you ever felt, you're sure to find the fabric and texture that's right for you. And with free fabric swatch kits, you can see and touch all your fabrics and find the perfect choice. Each Joybird produced piece is made with the ultimate care and precision, using real wood without all those harmful chemicals and responsibly sourced materials. All Joybird handcraft pieces come with a limited lifetime warranty. And Joybird has a 365-day home trial. Skip the furniture store and bring the showroom home. Sit on it, sleep on it, and break it in. If you don't love your Joybird, return it. Joybird stands by its quality and craftsmanship. If it's not everything you hope for and dream for, send it back. Free returns within 2 weeks of delivery. Create furniture that matches your own fearless style at joybird.com/bestcase. See how Joybird can help make your dream space a reality today at joybird.com/bestcase. Go to joybird.com/bestcase and receive an exclusive offer for 25% off your first order by using the code BESTCASE. Hiring used to be hard. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, and a confusing review process. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it done, ZipRecruiter.com/bestcase. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job sites, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. You can even add screening questions to your job listing, so you can filter candidates and focus on the best ones. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, to try ZipRecruiter for free, our listeners can go to ZipRecruiter.com/bestcase. That's ZipRecruiter.com/bestcase. ZipRecruiter.com/bestcase. ZipRecruiter.
Question, Larry. So when you're talking to this former informant, I mean, obviously you knew about his credibility if he'd been an informant prior for you, but you have to worry about that. It certainly won't hold up in court, especially if he's not there to testify. So what are you thinking as he's talking to you? What are the avenues that you're going to go down now to try to learn more about A, whether he was telling the truth, and B, who the suspects might have been from the 11-8?
Well, having worked with him before, he had provided information that was good. And at times he provided information that wasn't. When you're working informant, you got to be careful on that end, because A lot of times they might have another motive, and 50% of the time they might lie to you. So you have to validate the information that they're giving you before you make any move. Of course, he didn't need to tell me anything. So of course I thought, you know what, let's look at him. And at that time, 11-8s were very active, and it kind of all made sense. And I'll get to some other issues that happened, because there was a homicide before my homicide, and there was a homicide after within a year span that we were told through street sources, it's the same gang. And not only the same gang, it was the same shooter.
All right. So what happened next?
So we started looking at doing some parole searches and probation compliance searches, maybe just to get things hot, all surfacing around 11-8s. A lot of those youngsters.
Can you tell us what a parole and probation search are?
If you have somebody that's on probation, obviously a condition of probation, if he has it, is search and seizure. They cannot deny a search and seizure at any time of day and night by a law enforcement officer. Parole automatically has search and parole conditions. And what you can do is you can search their person. You can go to their house. You can search their house, their car, anything that they own, you can search, because it's a condition of their probation or parole.
So you start doing these sort of the ruffle the feathers of the 118 eucalyptus gang, but
those badass spa members. No, I'm only kidding.
You know, we started hitting them. We started doing some compliance checks, and really, unfortunately, came out dry. Nothing, you know, 30 to 50 members, but all the youngsters, even though they were very active, didn't really have any priors. All the older guys did. And the older guys aren't going to say anything because the older guys agree, and they're all for the youngsters putting in the work. Why? Because they're not the ones getting in trouble.
And they're reaping the benefits.
That's right.
So it's not looking so good to solve these murders. What were the other two murders, the one before and the one after?
It just so happens that the murder that preceded the murder I was handling was handled by Detective Tim Johnson.
Oh, we all know Tim Johnson,
yeah,
don't we?
Yeah, who happens to be sitting here in the room just looking fabulous and and slick. Yeah,
with a smirk on his face.
But not saying anything and giving us the high sign to be quiet. Yeah, okay.
So I talked with Tim, Detective Johnson, and we went over the two cases. Again, he had heard also street sources, which doesn't give you much, but gives you something to maybe look at and dig deep into. And then there was a homicide that happened after, and that one was a call that came out of a hit and run victim that was found in the parking lot of Hawthorne High School. Mm. After further investigation and through street sources that called me, that was not a hit and run. Where the U mob controlled this apartment complex on Inglewood Avenue in El Segundo, apparently they had beat this older gentleman up because he did not pay for some of the prior purchases of cocaine from them, threw him over a balcony, and then drug his, which happens to be right across the street from the Hawthorne High School, drug his body across the street, left him for dead, which end up coming out as a passerby sees this body, thought must have got run over, and that wasn't the case at all.
So two different methods of murder, two different locations, one's shot, one's beaten to death and dragged. And so it was just the street sources at this point that put the two together.
Correct. And it all stemmed from this one guy that they said, I remember a couple informants that used to work for me would say, Grajeda, you got to get this guy in custody because he's creating havoc and he's shooting everything and anything. Okay, you willing to testify that? Have you seen it? No, I never saw that. That was told to me. Well, point me in the direction of who would want to testify against this guy. Nobody's going to testify against this guy because he's active, has a lot of pull. People are afraid.
So I just want to ask, in the two shooting cases, were you able to match ballistics or were there different weapons used?
No. Again, in my homicide, no casings found. I really don't remember of the first homicide. And the other one, the last one where the body was found, it was a beatdown,
right,
and thrown over in a balcony. So it wasn't anything to have to do with a gun.
So there's no slugs that were recovered from the bodies?
Nothing. And there's two reasons why we believe this must have happened. And again, through sources. The homicide that I'm currently talking about, where the gentleman was shot and killed on the porch, he was a cocaine addict. He also purchased drugs from 11-8 and apparently had not paid him back. And when I said paid him back, he was buying $5, $10 at a time. Through street sources, he owed them $15. $15.
Wow.
So that's what his life was worth.
Can you talk a little bit about this whole idea of trying to solve murders when the best sources, people who may have been witnesses, won't talk? Because I think that's something that law enforcement has faced for a long time. But you've now got, for example, in Chicago and Baltimore, you've got those clearance rates for homicides down at like 20 and 25%. And part of that is because nobody will assist the police in solving the crimes. Can you talk about how difficult that makes your job?
Well, as I'm talking about these three cases, it's very difficult. And you know what? As a law enforcement officer, you try and prod and get them to talk. Come on, you know what? You know, they're not going to come after you. If need be, we'll set you up somewhere. We'll hide you, this and that. They know that the officers can't protect them 24/7. So you understand their reluctance to get involved, but you still have to try to do it. It's very difficult. They all know. You got to understand something. In the gang world, everybody in that gang already knows who did what before you even respond out there. There's a lot of people out there. And that's why I believe informant work is so important, because those informants, and you can harvest or cultivate informants many different ways. But if they really trust you as an officer, they're going to tell you everything. And there's been cases that have been proven by informants coming forward hundreds of times. But when they say, I only heard this, this is the guy, and you know they know more than they're telling you, but they don't want to get on the stand, it's very difficult. And it's aggravating as a detective, because you know you probably have the right guy, but there's nothing to get him once you get him in court, and the DA's not going to file that. There's no way.
So you're in a situation now where you're hitting a lot of brick walls. What do you do to resolve that?
You know, another thing is you just try to, there's another way you can work it. Everybody knows everything. So you try to hit those other gangs that maybe don't have that pull, maybe don't know if they want to be in the gang, but they don't want to be in the gang. So they're kind of, you know, half and half. And you try to get them on something, and maybe you bring them in and maybe they'll talk about it, because they certainly don't want to go to jail. But what are the chances of this guy or girl coming to jail and telling the detective, oh no, so-and-so did it? You know that's not going to happen, but you just try everything that you can.
So what'd you end up doing?
You know, we worked it, and unfortunately, to this day, those three have not been solved. And I can tell you right now, that's very difficult, because my last 3 or 5 years in a certain detail, I must have ran many of those U-mobs who now have giant kind of just surfaced and went to other neighborhoods just to see if they had warrants or were wanted or anything like that. Maybe we can go grab them and then somehow bring that back in. But you know what? They think they're in the clear. But I truly believe that sometimes time will tell, and sometimes it may never be solved.
And sometimes they get away with murder.
And sometimes they get away with murder.
But you got to keep looking for the hammer, you know?
Yeah. And you know, and this is a thing, is there's three cases that were worked to the end. The result is to try to get them arrested and convicted. These cases will get picked up again. The unfortunate thing is it won't get picked up by me. And that's what makes it difficult as an officer. And the other reason is, in our department, when you're put in an assignment, you're only in that assignment for 5 years because you got a mandatory rotation. So once you're working a case and then your 5 years is over, you now go back to patrol. So guess what? You can't even put in any other time to those cases because you now have another responsibility. However, because we have an understanding with the sheriffs, they work it 24/7. But the sheriffs have a lot of cases that they have to deal with, and they do a great job. But if you look at the long-term solution, it's our homicide. It's the city of Hawthorne's homicide. You want to be able to solve this case. And when you can't, it's pretty devastating.
So the theory behind rotating you out is
what?
Why do they do that? I mean, doesn't it prevent you from basically developing good, solid informants and knowledge of the entire area and knowledge of the crime that happens? I mean, how do you reconcile that with the benefits versus the drawbacks of doing something like that?
I guess in a nutshell, Jim, it basically is giving every other officer an opportunity to work that assignment. Because if you have all these detective assignments and metro assignments and gang assignments, and it's you have that same person in there for 15, 20 years, those officers never get the opportunity to work different assignments. And I can tell you right now, anybody that goes that is a patrol officer for more than 5 years, you want to change. Mm. You need that change so I can see it. But on the flip side, in my opinion, you have narcotic officers, you have gang officers, and you have robbery homicide. They should have full-time of those three, at least one person that has done a great job that continues to love it and thrive and continues to move forward, that they should just keep those positions. If you see that that detective is still doing a fantastic job, just keep them in there.
To mentor the younger
people.
Yeah, I would think that you'd want to have at least half of the detective crew experienced and then rotate in the other half rather than rotating out everybody. It just doesn't seem like that's the best way to solve the most crimes and protect the most people.
Thus, that's why we have the understanding with the sheriffs, because they can do that. And that's why we do that. But I could tell you, Hawthorne does a great job with what they have. They always have very dedicated, hardworking officers and detectives. And that's all you can do. So, but homicide is the number one heinous crime that we work. And you wish you can solve all of them, but you have to have witnesses and people that are willing to testify. And when it's involving a gang, and especially somebody that's just at that time very active, not too many people are going to come forward.
Yeah. Wow. So this is the question we always ask at this point in the interview for you. Is this a best case or a worst case?
Oh, worse. By far the worst.
Can you tell us why?
I think I just stated earlier, it's just in you that you wish you could have solved every one of those crimes. And you know you can, but there's certain crimes, and you know when you're getting all these street sources telling you all, giving you this information, and there's two others that may be involved, and yet you can't solve it, it's not a good feeling.
And it sticks with you, doesn't it?
It sticks with you. And, you know, especially after you retire, I'm sure you know, you think about it, you know, especially you go and if you see some other crime that happened as you're retired and it's the same gang, you're like, so you're hoping one day that you get a call and like, hey, guess what? You know, we have a subpoena for you. What? Oh, we solved the crime. You know what? That would probably be one of the best calls I would get. So
that's awesome. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Larry, for coming in and talking to us about this very frustrating case and the situation that surrounds it. And we want to thank you also for your service and the dedication that you have to try to keep these communities safer and to solve these really difficult crimes.
Oh, no problem. Thank you.
The only thing I feel badly about is no one got to hear how funny you are, Larry, because you're one of the funniest guys I've ever met in my life. This is the type of guy, people, where when you go to work and you know Larry's going to be there, you just walk in and your whole face lights up.
Well, you know why?
Why?
Because Jim, he kind of scared me. I looked at all this accolades he has. I'm like, oh my, I'm in front of a guy that I'm like, I need to be serious here.
We just printed those up yesterday to make it look.
It's all fake, Larry. It's all fake. Yeah.
Anyway, thank you so much for coming in today, Larry. And Maureen, thank you for co-hosting today. And until next time, thank you for listening to Best Case, Worst Case. Signing off.
Best Case, Worst Case is an XG production. Produced by Jim Clementi at Empire Studios, LA. Engineered and edited by Mike Thal. Music composed and performed by Simba Tsumba. And hosted by Wondery.
You can listen to Best Case, Worst Case on your favorite listening app. We are on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you want to do something about child sexual abuse, Darkness to Light can help. Did you know that more than 90% of the time children are sexually abused by someone they know?
Jim, this isn't about stranger danger. It's about learning the true risks. Darkness to Light's training can help prevent, recognize, and react to child sexual abuse in your community.
When you make the decision to get involved, kids can be protected. It starts with you.
Visit www.d2l.org to take the training and learn more.
That's D2L.org.